From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a few of the things you ought to know about your credit cards. Like, after you sign up for that low-interest credit card with the fixed annual rate, somewhere in the fine print, it may say that the company reserves the right to raise the interest rate anytime for any reason. And those late fees you pay? The companies sometimes help you be a little late so they can slap you with the fees. We'll talk with Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren about the tactics used by some credit card issuers to get more money from you. She's written about and testified to Congress about credit card company deceptive practices. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Support for NPR comes from ThinkMap, maker of the Visual Thesaurus, an interactive dictionary and thesaurus that helps bring language to life. More at visualthesaurus.com. From the Joyce Foundation, dedicated to protecting the Great Lakes, fresh water at the heart of America, joycefdn.org. And from the Cato Charitable Foundation, advancing environmental values and saluting all those who work to sustain our world.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, I got another mailing from my credit card company alerting me to some changes in policy. As usual, I just threw it out. The print was really small, and I figured even if I did read it, I wouldn't understand it. But my guest can explain a lot of the credit card agreement fine print that we don't bother to read, that details why our interest rates rise and why we get slapped with fees. Elizabeth Warren has written and testified to Congress about unfair and deceptive credit card practices. She's a professor of law at Harvard University and specializes in credit card law and bankruptcy law. Her books include The Two Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broke. Elizabeth Warren, welcome to Fresh Air. We all get junk mail nearly every day offering us credit cards at low interest rates, but there's a catch or two with these low interest rates. Tell us about the catch.
Well, the basic model for pricing credit cards today is two tiers. They want to put a credit card in the hands of every man, woman, child who might use it, because the credit card companies make a small profit every single time you use that card. It's called the merchant discount fee. And so, you know, a couple of pennies on every dollar spent on a credit card adds up to about $21 billion for the credit card company. So it turns out to be a pretty nice chunk of change. But the real way they make their money, the sweet spot in the profits, is that they know when they hand out all those credit cards, some people are going to get into trouble with them. Some people are going to slip and stumble. Some will lose their jobs. Some will get sick. Some will just be irresponsible. But they'll move into a territory where they end up paying over-limit fees or late fees or default rates of interest. And that's where the profits just start racking up. And that's where the credit card companies make their real money. So last year, they sent out 8 billion pre-approved credit card solicitations to American families all over the country, hoping that every single one of those would be opened up and someone would take the credit, and they would either make a little bit of profit for the credit card companies or a whole lot of profit for the credit card companies.
Now, if you sign up for a low interest rate with a credit card, that low interest rate might not last for long. Why not?
Well, because the credit card company puts the low interest rate up front in great big letters, and then somewhere buried back in the fine print, reserves the right to change that interest rate and to change it and change it and change it. And they don't change it on the downslope. They change it on the upslope.
So what would give them cause to change it?
Well, would you like me to read you one?
Sure. You can read as part of a contract?
Yeah. I actually brought one today. I thought you might enjoy it. Your APR, that's your interest rate, may vary except as stated above. The APR for purchases and balance transfers is the greater of 13.99% or 9% over the index. The APR for cash advances is the greater of 19.99% interest or 18.5% over the index. The penalty rate APR is the index plus a margin of up to 26.50%. And when I said the index, there's a little asterisk, and if you look in the fine print, it says, the index is the highest one-month London Interbank Offered Rate, LIBOR, as quoted in the Wall Street Journal on any day during the 90 days immediately preceding the last day of each calendar month. You understand that the terms of your account, including the APRs, are subject to change. The APRs are not guaranteed, and they may change to higher APRs. Fixed APRs may change to variable APRs and vice versa. We reserve the right to change the terms at any time for any reason, in addition to the APR increases that may occur for failure to comply with the terms of your account. Now, what all that language said...
Yeah, what does it say? Boy, you lost me. You lost me a long time ago.
That's all right. when you got all the way to the end, the key word was right near the end when it said, "We reserve the right to change the terms at any time for any reason." In other words, I read you all of that gibberish, but the bottom line is they'll charge you whatever they want to charge you.
So they reserve the right to raise your interest rate at any time for any reason. What are some of the typical reasons they give you?
Well, the reasons, they don't give you a reason. I mean, let's start there. They don't stick an insert in the mailer and say, "You'll notice your interest rate went up this month for the following four reasons." No, they just change it and hope oftentimes that the customers won't notice. But if the customers do notice, and if you happen to call, sometimes the reason is because you went over limit. Sometimes the reason is because you were a day late in paying. Sometimes the reason is because you took out a different credit card somewhere else. Sometimes the reason is because you had a dispute with another credit card company or with another creditor, late on your car loan, for example. Sometimes the reason is because interest rates went up in the country generally. Sometimes the reason is because some clever MBA at the company figured out that if they raised everybody's interest rate by 2%, they could rake in a couple of more million dollars and most people wouldn't complain. In other words, the reason is whatever reason the credit card company decides is going to maximize its profits. They're looking for a number that will put the most dollars in their pocket without making you so mad that you'll close the account and walk away.
Now, you mentioned that they might raise your interest rate because you were late in a payment to another creditor. One, mm-hmm. How would they even know? And two, what business is it of this credit card company's if you're late with a payment to another credit card or to a store or whatever?
Well, you know, it's an interesting concept that didn't exist more than about 6 years ago. But some clever marketing strategist figured out that they could apply a term called universal default. And what that means is if you don't meet every payment that you're obligated to meet everywhere at every time, even if you're meeting payments to us, we're going to go ahead and increase your interest rate. And by the way, not just by a couple of points, we'll take you from that 11.99% that had been your standard up to 29.9%, what's known as a default rate of interest. It caught on quickly, partly spread through the industry, because again, it was another way to make profits for the credit card companies. They basically just run the information off your FICO score to see if someone has done it's a credit report. They're running a credit report, and they check to see if there's been any little dings somewhere else on your credit report. They jerk the interest rate up. And they figure if you've had a ding with someone else, you may be a little bit nervous about leaving them. So they've got a good chance of collecting, instead of 11.99% interest, collecting 29.99%.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Elizabeth Warren. She's a professor at Harvard Law School and an expert on credit card law and bankruptcy, and the author of a couple of books, including All Your Worth, which is financial advice to families. You know, we're talking about the fine print in the credit card contracts, which most people don't know about and which subject you to all kinds of, like, fees and raised interest rates. I think most of us who have credit cards have gotten slapped with late fees or other fees. And how much do the credit card companies rely on those fees for their profits?
Well, that's what's been interesting. The fee portion of credit card revenues has been the fast-growing part since about 2000. The old model used to be that you lent out money and got back a little bit from the merchant fee, and then those who paid over time paid interest. And that was really, those were the two sources of money for the credit card contracts. What's happened now, however, is the companies have figured out that by imposing fees, they're more likely to catch good payers, which I hope would include you, but to get an extra, you know, $49 from you here and $39 from you there, and to do that for millions more customers. And yet it won't make you quite mad enough to cancel the card and quit. In fact, the pricing model for many of these is that they will impose a fee, sometimes a fee for no reason at all. There was a company recently that just evidently hit everyone with a $75 fee. And then anyone who called and complained, they just canceled the fee. So that way they kept the customers who were the ones who were most alert and the crankiest, and they got an extra $75 from all the customers who were either inattentive or timid in dealing with the credit card companies. It's just a whole new pricing model out there.
I will say I had to contend with this once in the recent past, and I had to complain about it 3 months in a row before each month they would agree to do it, and each month it would be back again.
Well, you know, that's part of the problem here. My husband and I talk about this. When one of us hits a problem on our credit card company, and we both know what the answer is, call, and they will straighten it out. But it will cost us time. Mm-hmm. You'll be on the phone, you know, 15, 20 minutes every single time, and it won't get fixed in one call. And the credit card companies count on this. You know, you really have to remember here, think of it this way. It's you against an entire army of MBAs whose job is to do nothing but figure out how to maximize profits for the credit card companies, how to pick your pocket. So if that means, that some of these credit card companies, if that means leave you on hold for at least 9 minutes because half the people will just give up and decide they don't need to complain, they'd rather pay the $39 than have to wait any longer on hold, that'll be okay. They'll do it. And then, you know, you put somebody polite on the phone so that when they finally come on, oh, yeah, we'll fix it. And they don't fix it the first month. So you have to go through the whole process a second time. And, oh, they're very apologetic the second time. And really, really sorry the third time. But think, if you multiply that times 6 million cardholders, that's a lot of people who just give up and pay $39. And now, that's a lot of revenue.
What you're saying sounds very cynical. You're saying that a lot of credit card companies will keep hitting you with the same fee that they previously promised to take off the bill. And they're doing it in the hopes of just like wearing down your resistance. What evidence do you have that this is intentional as opposed to just a kind of bureaucratic problem?
Oh, look, they keep track. They know. Mistakes of adding a $75 extra charge to your credit card, that doesn't happen because it slips through the credit screen. Think about it the other way. How many errors go in the other direction? How many things have you bought that didn't eventually show up on your credit card charge? The mistakes all run in one direction, and the direction they run in is in the direction of the credit card company. You know, there have been cases now where ex-employees of the credit card companies come clean after the fact, rat the companies out, and ultimately sometimes end up with huge lawsuits against the companies for having defrauded their customers. So is there a credit card company that admits that this is their policy? No. But if you put the evidence together from all of the customers who've called in, from all the times that the card companies themselves have said they will change a practice across the board and then remove it for anyone who calls in and complains, not hard to put this together and understand what the profit-maximizing position for some of these credit card companies is.
My guest is Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren. We'll talk more about what to look out for with your credit card after a break. This is Fresh Air. Okay, I realize I'm in a slightly awkward position here. Elizabeth Warren is urging us to use credit cards cautiously, and now I'm going to ask you to make a pledge to your station. When you call your station, as I hope you will, the person answering your call is likely to suggest that you put your pledge on a credit card. That's because it saves the station manpower and postage when they don't have to mail out fulfillment letters. So here's what I think. Please make a pledge. Consider putting it on your credit card, but if you do, Elizabeth Warren would want you to try and pay your credit card bill in full to avoid interest. If you'd prefer to write a check, that's fine. It's a check we will be very grateful to get. Thank you for supporting our program and your station. If you're just joining us, my guest is Elizabeth Warren. She's a professor at Harvard Law School, and she's an expert on credit card law and bankruptcy, and the author of a couple of books, including All Your Worth, which is advice to families about what to do with your money. We were talking about how complicated and inscrutable the language on most credit card contracts is, and you once did an experiment about this with some of your students at Harvard. Would you tell us about this?
Well, it was not a deliberate experiment. I had said a couple of harsh things about credit cards companies a couple of times during the course of my bankruptcy class, which was a third-year class in the spring. In other words, I had students that were just a couple of months away from being full-fledged Harvard Law School graduates. And so a student came into my office early one morning and tossed down a credit card agreement in front of me, a solicitation, and it said 3% cash back, had a big lime green sticker on the front of it. And he said, "Now, Professor Warren, even you would have to admit this looks like a great deal." And I said, "Well, I tell you what, let's see." So I walked back to the photocopying machine and I made a photocopy front and back of this offer. And I took it in and I passed it out to my bankruptcy class, nearly 80 students. And I said, "Okay, committee of the whole, you can all talk about it, figure it out however you want. Tell me, I just want you to tell me two things. What's the effective interest rate on this card? And how do you get your 3% cash back?" And you know, people kind of chuckled. And I said, "Go." And I looked at the clock. And the students started calling out, "Oh, look down here in clause 21. And it says, wait, no." And then someone else would say, wait, that's taken back over here in clause 14. And they went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. It took an entire class working together, calling out, trying to read them, putting fingers in the right places, until they finally figured out that they think the base rate on that card was 17.99%, and you only got 3% cash back when you were paying 17.99% interest on the card. In other words, it was a 14.99% interest card. And it took 80 near lawyers the better part of an hour to figure that out. Now you tell me what chance the ordinary customer has to sit down and read it and know what the terms of his or her credit card are.
Now, everybody knows that you need to pay a minimum balance every month. Now, with most credit cards, if you owe money and you just pay the minimum every month, do you have any clue how long it would take to pay off everything that you owe?
Well, let me put it this way. The credit card companies sure hope you don't have a clue. Because if you did, you'd be very likely to stop using your credit cards. That's why they have fought legislation in Washington and legislation, for example, in the state of California that would require a credit card company to give you that piece of information. That is, one extra line on your credit card that's, you know, after they tell you what the minimum monthly payment is, that says, and if you make the minimum monthly payment, it will take you this number of years and this number of months to pay off your credit card. So let me give you an example based on a fairly typical credit card. If a young mother and father-to-be went out and spent $5,000 on the crib and the car seat and furnishing the nursery and setting up with diapers and all the fun things to get a baby going, and put that on their credit card, as the advertisement suggests they should, and they made the minimum monthly payments every month, the child would be grown, have graduated from college, have married, and have children of his or her own before that credit card bill would be paid off. It would take about 34 years under current amortization.
Now, you like to pay in full every month.
Yes.
But that means the credit card company isn't going to be making a lot of money off of you each month. Do they do things to try to dissuade you from paying in full?
Well, they do everything they can to try to get me to use my credit card more and to shift around on the dates when my credit card is due so that maybe I'll slip or stumble and not pay on time. You know, in the industry, I'm what's known as a deadbeat, somebody who pays in full on time, because I don't produce a lot of profits for the credit card companies. The people who are the sweet spot are the ones who are stumbling and slipping and falling and carrying balances. And those are the ones for whom many credit card companies are fighting tooth and nail to get them as customers. So if you think you're popular, try skipping a couple of payments and find out how popular you'll be.
Elizabeth Warren is a professor of law at Harvard University. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how credit card companies sometimes go out of their way to make sure your payments are a little late so they can charge you late fees. We continue our conversation with Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, in stores and online at bn.com. From TIAA CREF, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement, online at tiaacref.org. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/freshair.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Elizabeth Warren. She's written about and testified to Congress about unfair credit card practices. She's a professor of law at Harvard and is an expert on credit card and bankruptcy law. Her books include The Two-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broke. The credit card industry was deregulated in the early 1980s. How did that change the industry?
Well, America has always had usury laws, meaning there's an interest rate maximum that can be charged. And if you can't figure out how to make a profit without charging more than the maximum, you can't lend the money. To charge, for example, in the state of Pennsylvania at one point, to charge more than 18% was called loan sharking. And only very shady guys did it, and you could go to jail for it. But in 1979, the United States Supreme Court had a case in front of it interpreting a very obscure piece of banking legislation in which the question came up, if you had a bank, say, in Montana, and it was lending money to a customer, say, in California, and the two states had different usury laws, which one would apply? And most people thought it was the customers. That is, you would be protected by your own state laws. Pennsylvania people are protected by Pennsylvania law, California people by California law. But the United States Supreme Court read this kind of ambiguous language, and they said, we think actually what Congress intended here is it would be the state where the bank is incorporated. Even though it's a federally chartered bank, it's where the bank is located. And so you can almost hear this pause at this moment. And South Dakota says to itself, let's see, jobs, clean industry, and most of the people who have credit cards don't live in South Dakota. So South Dakota repealed its usury laws. And Citibank said, South Dakota, here we come, and moved to South Dakota and started issuing credit cards all over the country, effectively circumventing all of the local usury laws. Well, the next thing that happens is Delaware says, oh, me too, we can raise our usury rates so that companies will come here. And then the game was afoot so that we effectively engaged in the single biggest policy change in the credit area, the whole consumer credit area, through an obscure Supreme Court decision interpreting some ambiguous language. Congress could have easily reversed it, but did not. And so we went from a country that had usury rates from colonial times until 1979, and then they effectively just died.
Now, just a couple of years ago, in 2005, Congress passed tighter bankruptcy laws. How has that affected the credit card industry and consumers who have credit cards?
Well, it has emboldened them. By making it harder for customers to say, that's it, you have loaded me up on these credit cards that I could not ever possibly pay off. I'm headed to see a lawyer, and I'm headed from there into the bankruptcy courts. By just making it a little harder to do that, the credit card companies anticipate that they can squeeze customers even harder. So let me just give you an example. We've seen the direct proof in what happens. Credit card companies, between 2005, before the law was in effect, and into 2006, the first year after the law went into effect, increase the number of mailings offering pre-approved credit cards by 30%. I mean, you weren't getting enough prior to the change in the bankruptcy laws. They're out there looking harder for more customers, and particularly for shaky customers. They're pushing them harder with tricks and traps pricing, knowing that they can hang on to them longer, because those people will be less likely to declare bankruptcy than they were under the old laws. So it's been a real heyday. It's the credit card companies who pushed for this law. They were the ones who literally drafted the law. Their lobbyists wrote it, and they paved its way through Washington, got it through, and now they're reaping the profits from it.
What is the credit card lobby like?
Well, it's rich. They sure do dress nice. And they sure spend a lot of money. Financial services, over the last 6-7 years, has been either the number one giver or one of the top three givers in campaign contributions every single year. They have really spread their money around Washington. The bankruptcy law that you just mentioned, I talked to senators and representatives who said that they received 2 and 3 personal calls from lobbyists. I mean, in person, people who showed up in person 2 and 3 a day, every single day, month after month after month, to emphasize just how important it was for Senator X or Congressman Y to vote the right way on this bankruptcy bill. They got a lot of money to spend.
How do you choose which credit cards you're going to take out and how many you're going to have?
Oh, well, how many I'm going to have is easy. I have 2. That's all I want.
Do you study the interest rates before you agree to the terms of a credit card?
No, there's no point in it.
They're going to change it anyways?
They're going to change it anyway, lady. I mean, you know, we all think we're being so clever. We think we're making money off these credit cards. And the very few studies that have been done show that even the smartest among us are losing money on these credit cards. We're paying for the privilege. And what's remarkable about this is the credit card companies themselves are not making a little bit of money on it. They're making huge amounts of money. They're making grotesque amounts of money. And look, I'm a commercial law professor. I like profit. I think profit is a terrific thing. I think contracts are a terrific thing. But this is an area that is just spun out of control. And it's costing Americans more than $90 billion a year. That's what we're paying for this credit card system. And it's mostly ordinary middle-class families, people who have jobs, people who go to work every day, who are spending just on average about $1,400, $1,500 a year in interest if nothing goes wrong, and thousands of dollars in interest if they have a slight stumble, a slight slip, a slight fall. We have pushed Americans to a point that they live in it's like living on the edge of a cliff. They start to fall over, they scramble back. That's where much of middle-class America is living today. I just have to tell you, just came out last week, one of these surveys with Bankrate. 36% of Americans with credit cards, it's 1 in every 3 Americans who's got a credit card, is worried they're not going to be able to make their credit card bills, that they can't pay their bills. 60% of Americans are carrying a balance on their credit cards. 40% of Americans missed at least 1 credit card payment in the last 2 years. 23%, 1 in every 4 American families is maxed out on at least 1 credit card. And here's the one that just scares me to death. 1 in every 7 Americans today is dealing with a debt collector because they can't make their payments. This is a world turned upside down. This is not what America looked like in 1980. This is not what America looked like in 1997. But this is what's happened to America in just the last half dozen years.
My guest is Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren. We'll talk more about what to look out for with your credit card after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Let's get back to our interview with Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren. She's an expert on credit card company deceptive practices. The statistics all say that Americans owe more in credit card debt than they ever did before. I mean, is that just because credit cards are more easily available than ever before, or are there other reasons for that?
Well, it's really two things working together. One is that credit cards are much more heavily marketed than they ever were before. You know, we don't see ads on television for saving your money, for putting it away and having it for a rainy day. Instead, the credit card companies are spending literally hundreds of millions of dollars to try to get you to take on more debt. That's what it's really about. I mean, their product is a fungible product. It's just dollars. They only make their money if you really borrow. The other reason is that American families are just under a lot more economic pressure than they have been in the past. Over the last generation, median wages for a fully employed male have remained flat. That is, you know, today a man who's fully employed earns about $800 less than a fully employed man did 30 years ago. But expenses for the basics, like a three-bedroom, one-bath house, has gone up by 70% in inflation-adjusted dollars. The cost of health insurance has gone up. The cost of transportation has gone up. The cost of childcare has gone up. So families, even hardworking families, even two-income families, just have less money at the end of the month than they used to. And they increasingly are using their credit cards to pay for things like medical care and school supplies. I really wish the run-up in credit cards was nothing more than too many iPods and, you know, too much Prada and too much Gucci. But the serious research on this shows that the run-up has a lot more to do with people who lose their jobs and who get sick and who are turning to credit cards as a way to try to make it to the end of the month when they've run out of money. It's not easy out there for families.
So, you know, we're talking about late fees and how credit card companies make a lot of money on these late fees. You don't have a lot of time to pay your bill before your time is up and you owe the late fee. How do they calculate how much time they give you in that window before you're hit with a late fee?
Oh, there's some very clever things that go on here. So one of the tricks that some of the companies use is that they give you a date when your payment is due. Let's just say the 7th of the month. And they do that for 6 months running. And then with no notice at all, they move it back to the 4th of the month on the next bill. So that a much higher proportion of people will simply get it wrong. And they will think they're the ones who messed it up, who didn't get it right. Another trick for collecting late fees is for people who live on the East Coast, the pre-printed envelope for where your bill is to be mailed is to some small city on the West Coast, and always a small city because it takes mail longer to make it both all the way across the country and then out of a major metropolitan area and into a small town. But if you're on the West Coast, they make your bill processing center on the East Coast in a small town so that it will take everybody longer in the mail. There are allegations that various credit card companies delay opening bills. There are even allegations about companies that have allegedly shredded bills. Why? Why would anyone ever shred a payment? The answer is so they can get those late fees. And sure, there'll be some customers who'll complain. There'll be some customers who'll get furious and stop carrying the card. But the truth is, most of us have jobs and dinner to make and homework to check for the kids and the dog to feed, and we won't notice. And we'll just pay it. We'll think we were the ones who were doofs and didn't get it right. And that's how the credit company rakes in another $1 billion.
You know, some people say that even if you have a credit card that you no longer want to use, for your credit rating, keep that account open. Is that good advice?
Well, it depends. I closed the last few credit cards that I had a few years back, and it hasn't hurt, but that's because I don't carry a balance on my credit cards that nears the cap. What you always want to have on your credit card, both frankly for your FICO score and for your own peace of mind, is you want to have room to run up a balance if an emergency ever struck and you needed it. That room on your cards improves your credit score. So if canceling out your unused cards means you're out of extra room, probably a bad idea from a FICO point of view. Mm-hmm. If not, get rid of them.
We're talking about credit cards. Like, say your credit card rating becomes bad because you've been overdue or you missed a payment or something. Are credit reports being used in different ways than they used to be?
You know, the whole idea behind a credit report used to be that creditors needed a way, they thought, to talk to each other. To say, in effect, well, look, if, you know, he's not making the payments to Citibank, he's not likely to make the payments to me, so I'm not going to lend him any money. And that was kind of the basic idea behind credit reports. Credit reports are now used for job applications. They're used for determining whether or not you can get homeowner's insurance. In other words, if you get into a bad place with your credit card company, the effect may actually be to diminish your total life chances, that it can impair your ability to get a job or to have car insurance or life insurance, health insurance.
Are more employers now checking the credit ratings of people who are there considering hiring?
Yes, ma'am. Many employers now check credit ratings and just won't hire people who have dings on their credit. And of course, let's be clear here, bill collectors now know this. And so among the things that some bill collectors will now tell people is, and if you don't pay us, let me tell you where else it's going to hurt you. I mean, this really turns up the heat under what it means to fall behind on your credit cards.
I want to say something in praise of credit card companies.
Okay.
Okay, I've had my number stolen by who knows who, but a couple of times I've had a lot of charges that I had nothing to do with, and the credit card company cleared it up. They did a commendable job with it, and I didn't have to pay anything extra.
You know, I think that's wonderful. I'm delighted for you, but that's federal law. It's not your credit card company that protected you. Once you show that it's not your charge, the credit card company legally can't charge you. Those were federal laws that were passed back in the 1970s that protected you. They were nice to you. They straightened it out. They took it off your bill, because if they hadn't, they would have been in violation of federal law.
And they've called me a few times and said, these charges seem very out of character. And although they were actually mine, I kind of appreciated the call because they might not have been mine. And I didn't mind spending a minute on the phone to clear that up, but I thought that's a way to protect me.
I don't mind, but you have to understand, it wasn't a way to protect you, it was a way to protect themselves. Because if a stranger had been using your card, a thief had been using your card, the credit card company would have been responsible for those charges, not you. They were asking for your help to keep themselves from having to pay that extra money. They weren't kindly trying to help you out. I hate to destroy your illusions, but they were protecting themselves, not you.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Elizabeth Warren, for talking with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Elizabeth Warren is a professor of law at Harvard University. This is Fresh Air. Now that we've learned all about some of the secret costs of credit cards, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to ask you for money. No, this isn't a ploy to get you to use your credit card. It's just what we absolutely have to do this time of year in order to make ends meet at your radio station. When you make a pledge, you're making it possible for your station to continue broadcasting and for the station to continue bringing you fresh air. If you pay by credit card, we hope we've helped you avoid fees and high interest rates. Whether you pay by credit card or check, we will be very grateful to you. Thanks. Saxophonist and clarinetist Ned Rothenberg has always been a musical cosmopolitan. Early on, he studied jazz with George Coleman and shakuhachi flute in Japan. Later, Rothenberg put together his North African-influenced double band and toured in duos with the Tuvan throat singer Sanko Namchalak and the shakuhachi virtuoso Katsuya Yokoyama and English saxophone improviser Evan Parker. But jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Rothenberg's new album sends him back to his roots.
Ned Rothenberg on clarinet. As he tells it, recording was underway for the new album by his long-running trio Sync, plus two strings, when he began to think this might be the quote-unquote Jewish record producer John Zorn had been requesting for years. As a secular Jew and musical globalist, Rothenberg had resisted the idea. But this time, prompting himself with a Mideastern scale or Sephardic syncopation or two, he heard the music filtered through his own bedrock culture. So he called his record Inner Diaspora, marking a personal journey that began with one culture and moved out into many. Ned Rothenberg's core trio reflects multiple diasporas and dispersed populations. He goes way back with African-American guitarist and bass guitarist Jerome Harris, who often plays with drummer Jack DeJeanette and has toured with Sonny Rollins. Calcutta-born, New York-based tabla virtuoso and dumbek player Samir Chatterjee has played with musicians from Ravi Shankar to Ravi Coltrane. The trio's members all step outside their home traditions in a convincing way. Ned Rothenberg on the Japanese shakuhachi. The added strings on these sessions are violinist Mark Feldman and cellist Eric Friedlander. They play together in a few bands, including Zorn's Masada String Trio, and have a chamber duo's seamless blend. Bowed strings can make any music more soulful and poignant, but Rothenberg often puts strings at the service of the overlapping rhythm patterns he loves above all, the irresistible dance of wheels upon wheels that propels music around the world. Ned Rothenberg's expanded resources let him keep those hoops a-spinning. But the strings do bring forth a lyrical side of his personality, sometimes crowded out by other interests. Maybe that's another aspect of his inner diaspora. He reaches down deep for that heartfelt stuff, then takes it out on the globe for a spin.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross, reminding you can download podcasts of our program on our website, freshair.npr.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Are religion and science antithetical? Oxford evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins thinks so. On the next Fresh Air, Dawkins talks about atheism and his controversial best-selling book, The God Delusion. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.